You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 164 by Rudolf Steiner, 11 lectures entitled The Value of Thinking for a Cognition that Satisfies the Human Being. That was the first section. The second section is entitled The Relationship Between Spiritual Science and Natural Science, which is the rest of the lectures. Again, the book overall is entitled The Value of Thinking. This is the first lecture in the second section, which is lecture 5 in our sequence. Sorry for that confusion. Given in Dornach on 26th September 1915. Today I am going to give neither a lecture nor a reading, but I'm going to discuss some things of the kind that I believe are still lacking in our branches. I will build on the brochure titled Science and Theosophy by F. von Wrangel, published in Leipzig by Max Altman in 1914. In doing so, I would like to show in particular how the discussion can build on such a text. The title Science and Theosophy obviously touches on a question which is important for us to think through, for we will very often be in the position of hearing the objection against our movement that it is not scientific, or that the scientist doesn't really know what to do with it. In short, to deal with science in some way will certainly very often be necessary for one or the other among us, because they will have to face this objection, and perhaps also be pointed to some particular things in the process. Therefore, it will be good to build on the observations of a man who is of the opinion that he stands entirely within the scientific spirit of the present time, and of whom, when you have read through the pamphlet, you can easily say that he deals with the relationship of science and theosophy in a very perceptive way, and in such a way that he creates a relationship which many will try to create who stand precisely within the scientific enterprise of our time. And we, or at least a certain number of us, must be able to think along with such people who want to create a relationship between science and theosophy. Since, moreover, the pamphlet is written with a favorable view of theosophy, we need not initially lapse into polemics, into criticism, but can attach to the author's thoughts some things that arise from the specifics of our spiritual striving. Of course, some of us, if we were writing such a pamphlet, might even avoid the title Theosophy, after the various experiences we have had in such an investigation. This is a question that can perhaps be examined more closely in the course of reading the pamphlet itself. The pamphlet is divided into individual, easily comprehensible chapters and bears as its motto a saying by Kant which reads, quote, "It is not correctly spoken when people always say in the lecture halls of wisdom that there cannot exist more than one single world in the metaphysical sense," close quote from Kant. Steiner again. Taken out of context like this, we can certainly not learn a great deal from this statement by Kant. The author of this text, however, wants to refer to Kant with the thought that Kant wanted to say with this statement that the worldview created by external science does not have to be regarded as the only possible one. Here Kant's opinion is perhaps not entirely accurately interpreted by the author of this little text, for Kant basically means something else in his context. Kant means, when the human being thinks metaphysically, they can think of different real worlds, and the question is then why, of these different conceivable possible worlds, the one in which we live exists for us, whereas for the author of this little text, the question is there the possibility of having other worldviews apart from the materialistic worldview? Of course, he is of the opinion that a different, a spiritual worldview must also apply to this world of ours. Then the text begins with its first essay, which bears the title, quote, "Preliminaries. A powerful spiritual movement has currently taken hold of the European cultural world, in contrast to the materialistic intellectual current that was the dominant one in the leading intellectual circles around the middle of the 19th century. Close quote. So in a sense, the author looks at the goings-on of intellectual work around him and finds that things have changed from what they were around the middle of the 19th century. That around the middle of the 19th century, scientific salvation was found precisely in materialism, while now, in the period in which this booklet was published, 1914, a powerful spiritual movement has taken hold of European culture. Now he goes on to say, quote, "What are the inner reasons for this counter-current? It seems to me that they lie not only in the metaphysical needs of people, but also, at least in part, in the frequently awakened consciousness of the danger facing the ethos of humanity, which is connected with the rule of a materialistic worldview." Close quote. So, the author of this little text is one of those who not only believes that the 20th century has awakened a metaphysical need in humanity, but also believes that there is a certain ethical danger in the fact that people's minds are being taken over by the materialistic worldview. Quote, "With increasing speed, the materialistic current of thought is pouring through numerous channels, from the intellectual heights into the low places of human society. And there it is displacing the religious convictions based on reverence, which provided the firm support for the moral life of the masses. It is becoming increasingly clear to many that the victory of the materialistic worldview inevitably leads to a materialistic view of life, bringing about a corresponding way of life which sees the only reasonable measure of life in the exploitation of our brief lifespan for as much enjoyment as possible. In earlier times, too, when a firm moral edifice based on tradition and authority succumbed to the corrosive criticism of reason, the pursuit of crude, sensual pleasure seized humanity and led it along ruinous paths that distanced it from what we feel is its proper destiny. This is not contradicted by the fact that among the men who, animated by an unconditional love of truth, make the results of their research and thinking known to their fellow human beings, regardless of what consequences this may entail, that among these men many, if not most, occupy a high level of moral greatness and are driven by noble, selfless motives, fully convinced that they are thereby serving humanity." Close quote. So here, the author points out that certain dangers for the moral life of human beings must arise as a consequence of a materialistic worldview. And he says, this danger cannot be countered solely with the objection that those people who theoretically recognize the materialistic worldview as their own, and as the right one, themselves occupy a high level of moral conduct. The author touches here, from his own observation, on a point to which I have repeatedly referred in our spiritual science, I may well say, from a higher point of view. If a person says that such an eminently theoretical and materialistic spirit as Haeckel, for example, occupies the ground of high moral ideals in life, and also shows in his life a higher moral conception of life, and that therefore the materialistic worldview does not necessarily entail a materialistic way of life, then they forget one thing, and I have pointed this out in various lectures I have given. Namely, they forget that in the development of humanity, feelings and thoughts move at different speeds. If you survey just a short section of the historical development of humanity, you will find that thoughts move relatively quickly. From the 15th and 16th centuries onward, materialistic thinking, the expression of human theoretical reflection in materialistic thought, developed rapidly, and all sciences were gradually permeated, theoretically, by materialistic forms of thought. The moral life, which lives in feelings, has developed less rapidly. At least people still reveal in their old sentiments and feelings that feeling hasn't followed on so quickly. That is why people today still live in the spirit of the moral feelings that resulted from the previous worldview. And that is why there is a dichotomy today between materialistic thinking and what is still, in the old spirit, a non-materialistic life and a non-materialistic way of living. But the time is approaching when the consequences will be drawn from the materialistic theoretical worldview, so that on the threshold there stands what can be described as the moral life being flooded by the consequence of the materialistic worldview. So you can significantly deepen your understanding of the different speeds that feelings and thoughts have if you look at them in terms of spiritual science. Now it says further, quote, "But if the end result of this intellectual work is one that seems to us to be in contradiction with the determination of the human being, then the question is justified as to whether there is not a fundamental error in the seemingly so solid structure of critical reasoning." Close quote. The author is thus convinced that immorality must follow from theoretical materialism, and that he can expect salvation for humanity only from morality. And so he asks himself whether a materialistic worldview, which must necessarily lead to immorality, not only shows up false, but has faults in itself, if looked at critically. And so he goes on writing, quote, "Does this error manifest itself only through feeling, or can it also be discovered through reason? This question has also preoccupied me, and in the following I will try to clarify it for myself. I hope that my reasoning will also interest some readers who, like me, are convinced that it is more effective to fight an error of reason with its own weapons than to call only feelings into the fray against it. In order to describe my scientific stance, I will mention that by training I am an astronomer, that my independent work is in the field of theoretical meteorology and physical geography, and that from my early youth I have moved almost exclusively in academic circles, and that respect for rigorous science based on critical thinking has, so to speak, become second nature to me." Close quote. With this, though, the author can justify that he has something to say about the relationship between science and theosophy, because he shows that he knows science in a certain point, and that his judgment must therefore be worth infinitely more than the judgment of someone who, for example, reads Kant and says that this is all nonsense. We theosophists do not need to read Kant, and who thus only reveals that they themselves have perhaps not seriously read and thought through even five lines of Kant. It further says, quote, "I am firmly convinced that a worldview which cannot stand up to strict critical reasoning is of no lasting value, no matter how much it may appeal to the feelings." These introductory words should inform the reader about the task I have set myself in this text and the perspective from which I have intended to approach it. Close quote. The next essay describes in a few sentences what a materialistic, mechanical worldview is, the worldview which developed in the last half of the 19th century, in such a way that there were and still are many who consider what the author describes here, in a few sentences, to be the only scientifically possible worldview. Let us consider what the author writes, quote, "The basic assumptions of the materialistic mechanical worldview." Let us begin by considering the most central basic assumptions of a materialistic mechanical worldview. They can be summarized in the following tenets. Number one, all events that we observe through our senses and perceive through our thoughts proceed according to laws. That is, every state of the cosmos is necessarily conditioned by the state that precedes it in time, and just as necessarily results in the states that follow it. All changes, that is, all events, are inevitably consequences of the forces present in the cosmos. Close quote. Now, what the author is trying to analyze here as the basic assumption of the materialistic mechanical worldview has also been said many times in the course of our lectures. But if you compare what the author says here with the way it is said in our lectures, you will notice the difference. And for those who want to enter into our spiritual, scientific consciousness, it is good if on occasion they make themselves aware of this difference. Anyone who reads through this first point in which the materialistic mechanical worldview is characterized in a beautiful, perceptive, and scientifically knowledgeable manner will see this is very good. This captures the materialistic mechanical worldview. But when we try to characterize such things in the lectures that are given for the purpose of our movement, it is in a different way that we specifically attempt to do so. And it would be good to think about how we do such things differently in our case. Mr. von Rangel reproduces what can be called the materialistic mechanical worldview, does he not? He says a few sentences of his own making in which he summarizes his impressions of the matter. You will have noticed, if you presume to notice such things at all, that I usually don't do it this way, but quite differently. As a rule, I start from something that is there, that is really there as a result of an historical process. And so, when I wanted to characterize this point, I did not simply say such words, starting with myself, but I chose any of the significant and indeed the good authors to say, in the words and in the manner of such an author, what the matter in question is. Thus I have often attached to the name Dubois-Raymond that which could serve as a basis for my lectures. This may often, if you do not see the whole thing in context, have led you to believe that I wanted to criticize Dubois-Raymond, but I never want to criticize. I only want to single out a characteristic representative, so that it is not me who has to speak, but he speaks. This is what we might call the sense for the facts we require, the spirit in which we do not make assertions, but let the facts speak for themselves. For example, I have often told you that Dubois-Raymond gave a speech on the cognition of nature at the Leipzig Naturalists' meeting in 1872. He also spoke at the time about the way he had arrived at his view of the world from his scientific research. Dubois-Raymond is a physiologist according to his special field of research. His main work is in the field of nerve physiology. He has often spoken out about the naturalist's view of the world in eloquent words. Thus he also spoke about the limits of the scientific worldview, about the limits of the knowledge of nature at this Leipzig Naturalist meeting of 1872, and in doing so, he also spoke about the Laplacian mind. What is it? Dubois-Raymond characterized it at the time. This Laplacian mind is the one which is versed in the mathematics, physics, biology, chemistry, and so on, of the present, and forms a worldview from these sciences. Such a Laplacian mind thus comes to form a worldview based on the so-called astronomical understanding of reality. What is the astronomical understanding of reality, we might now ask? What is astronomical understanding? We can make it clear to ourselves in a few words. The astronomer pictures the sun, the planets, the moon, the earth. They picture the planets revolving around the sun or moving in ellipses around it. They picture the force of attraction, gravity acting on the planets. They picture a force of momentum, and out of this momentum they picture that the planets revolve around the sun. In this way, the astronomer has in mind that they can follow what is going on around them, in the cosmos, as the great events, that they could follow them out of the material entities that are to be seen in space, and out of the forces that they exert on each other in space. Through the entities exerting material forces on each other, things are set in motion. That is, things are set in motion when you imagine the solar system like this and look at it like this. You have a picture of the things spread out in space and the events that happen over time. Now, the person who wants to form a worldview in the sense of Dubois-Raymond, which has kept pace with the time, says the following. We must assume that all matter consists of the smallest parts of atoms. Just as the solar system consists of the sun, the moon, and the planets, so also the smallest piece of matter consists of something similar, like the sun with its planets. And as the sun exerts forces, and as the planets emit forces between themselves and act on each other, so do the forces among the individual atoms. This sets the atoms in motion. So we have a movement inside every material particle. The atoms, like the sun and the planets, are in motion. The movements may be small movements, but they are such that we can compare them with the great movements that are performed by the heavenly bodies outside in space. So that if we take the smallest piece of matter that we can see, Something is going on inside, like that which the astronomer imagines outside in the universe. And then natural science came to imagine all this in such a way that wherever something is really in motion, this is due to the fact that the atoms are guided by their forces. In the second half of the 19th century, thermodynamics, as founded by Julius Robert Meyer, Joule, Tyndall, and Helmholtz, and further developed by Clausius and others, particularly contributed to the formation of this worldview. Thus it is said when we touch a body and feel heat, that which we have there as the sensation warm is only appearance. What really exists outside is that the smallest parts, the atoms of the substance in question, are in motion, and we know a state of heat when we know how the atoms are in motion, when we have, to use Dubois Raymond's words, an astronomical understanding of it. The ideal of the Laplacian mind would be to have attained the point when we say, what do I care about heat? My view of the world depends on finding out the movement of atoms, which through their movement cause everything we have in terms of heat, light, and so on. This Laplacian mind thus forms a worldview that consists of space, matter, with its active forces, and movement. So Dubois Raymond, in that lecture he gave on the limits of the understanding of nature at the Leipzig Naturalists meeting, sets up this ideal of the Laplacian mind, and he asks, what would such a Laplacian mind be able to do? You see, his ideal is the astronomical understanding of the world. If a mathematician takes the picture of our solar system, as it is at any given point in time, they only have to put certain numbers into their formula, and they get a picture of how it was an hour ago, 3 hours ago, 10 years ago, centuries ago. How do we go about calculating whether a solar or lunar eclipse occurred at a certain time in the first decade of our era? For that, you have formulas developed according to the current state of science. You only need to insert the corresponding numbers into the formula, so you can calculate each individual state. You can calculate when a solar eclipse will occur, say in 1970 or in 2728. In short, you can calculate any state preceding or following in time. And now the Laplacian mind would have to have the formula that encompasses this whole solar system. So anyone who had this Laplacian mind, which encompassed the atoms that are in space and all the states of motion, could, and Dubois Raymond also says this, calculate today from the broad formula that they have about the atoms in their present states of motion, for example, when Caesar crossed the Rubicon. They only need to insert what is necessary into the formula. It would only depend on how the atoms stood at that time, and the fact would have to follow. Caesar crossed the Rubicon. If you put certain values into the formula, a certain picture of the present state of the atoms should emerge, and then you would be able to recognize it. For example, the Battle of Salamis. You would also have to go on from differential to differential, and you would be able to reconstruct the whole Battle of Salamis. This is the ideal of the Laplacian mind, an understanding of the world that is called astronomical. Other things may be added on occasion about these things. Now, I just want to mention a little experience for those who are observing these things. As a boy, I once got hold of a school program. Such school programs are printed, after all. Inside, there is usually an essay written by one of the teachers. This essay was not that easy for me to understand at the time, because it had the title, The Force of Attraction Considered as an Effect of Motion. There I was already dealing with an author at the time who had, so to speak, also set himself the ideal of the Laplacian mind. And he set out many other things in the same direction. If you put all this together, you will see that I did not try to speak in accordance with the mere idea of an astronomical, materialistic view of the world, but to let the facts, the personalities, speak for themselves. So that in a certain sense I really strove to cultivate a style of presentation that eliminates the personal. For when I told you what Dubois Raymond spoke on a special occasion, I let him speak and not me. My task is only to follow up what these persons have said. I try to let the world speak. This is an attempt to eliminate yourself, not to tell your own views, but facts. When reading this point of Rangel's, we should realize that our spiritual science, even in the way it is presented, strives for a sense of facts, a sense of not merely dabbling in objectivity, but the sense of immersing ourselves in the facts, of really immersing ourselves in them. Now you will recognize what I have extracted from the facts if you let the following lines of the booklet sink in. Quote, "All events that we observe through our senses and perceive through our thoughts proceed according to laws. That is, every state of the cosmos is necessarily conditioned by the state that precedes it in time, and just as necessarily results in the states that follow it. All changes, that is, all events, are inevitable consequences of the forces present in the cosmos." Close quote. And now it says further, quote, "It does not affect the essence of the question, whether we, for the sake of better clarity, call the vehicle of the forces matter, or, according to the practice of monists, imagine the concept of energy as the only effective thing, which, although it presents various forms of appearance to the human senses, basically represents an unchangeable sum of latent or actual possibilities of movement." Close quote. Such a sentence, too, I would only put in the rarest of cases, and only when other things have already been summarized. Remember that I also once spoke about what is expressed in this sentence. It says, quote, "It does not affect the essence of the question whether we, for the sake of better clarity, call the vehicle of the forces matter, or, according to the practice of the monists, imagine the concept of energy as the only effective thing." Close quote. I wouldn't say that, but I would really point to the students of Haeckel and Büchner, who above all look at the matter that is distributed in space. These were, as the Swabian Fischer puts it, the collectors of matter. Then came the person who is now the chairman of the Monist League, Ostwald. He gave a lecture at a naturalist meeting, I think it was the one in Kiel, I have already spoken of it, on overcoming materialism through energetics, through energism. He pointed out that it was not the material that mattered, but the force. So he replaced matter with force. Remember how I quoted his words that he used at that time? He said, in essence, if a person receives a slap in the face from another, for that person, it is not a matter of the substance, but of the force with which they receive the slap. Nowhere do we perceive the matter, but the force. And therefore force, or not only in a certain paraphrase, but a certain transformation, energy, was substituted for matter. But this energism, which now calls itself monism, is nothing other than a masked materialism. Again, I tried to show you with an example how there really was once a time when the collectors of matter were replaced by the collectors of energy. I did not try to present a theoretical proposition, but to characterize it from the reality. And that must be our aspiration in general, for it is only through this that we come to develop a sense of what is real in the spiritual, that we have a sense of what is real in the physical, and do not chew on our own assertions. So the author of the booklet says, quote, "It does not affect the essence of the question whether we, for the sake of better clarity, call the vehicle of the forces matter, or, according to the practice of the monists, imagine the concept of energy as the only effective thing." Close quote. Warmth is one way, the tool, as it were, of getting slapped in the face. Light is the other way. And if you look at the different sense organs, you have to say that the slaps each have a different effect. For example, when they fall in the eyes, the same slap acts as light phenomena. That is also the theory. Just look again at the words. Quote, "It does not affect the essence of the question whether we, for the sake of better clarity, call the vehicle of the forces matter, or, according to the practice of the monists, imagine the concept of energy as the only effective thing, which, although it presents various forms of appearance to the human senses, basically represents an unchangeable sum of latent or actual possibilities of movement. Close quote. What the author means here by the expression latent or actual possibilities of movement can be made clear to you in this way. Imagine here some kind of a stopper, and on top of it a tube, a glass tube, with water inside. This water weighs down on the bottom here. The moment I pull the stopper away, the water runs down. In the latter case, we are dealing with an actual movement. Before I pulled the stopper away, the same force was there, only it was not actual, but dormant. Everything of the water that then flowed down and became actual, that was latent before, not actual. Quote, "The course of all events is unalterably given, and the human being too is just as unfree in their thinking, feeling, volition, as, for example, the stone is as it falls." Close quote. That is the necessary consequence of the worldview of the Laplacian mind, that when I put my hand there, that is an image of the moving atoms. And if the Laplacian mind can still calculate the image, as I have indicated, then that excludes the freedom of the human being. That is, the Laplacian mind excludes the freedom of the human being. This is the first point that Mr. von Wrangel makes on the basis of the materialistic mechanical worldview. The second point is the following, number two, quote, "The inner experiences which take place in the consciousness of the human being, their feelings, thoughts, will impulses, are not essentially different from other processes in nature, which the human being observes through their senses. These inner experiences are only byproducts of material processes within the human brain and nervous system." Close quote. In the second point, then, it is expressed that when I think, feel, and want, this is only a byproduct of the inner processes that the Laplacian mind chooses. So we are not dealing with independent thoughts, feelings, and will impulses, but only with byproducts. If you follow what I have said, for example, in the lecture titled The Legacy of the 19th Century, and in similar other lectures, if you study some of what is contained entitled The Riddles of Philosophy, then you will see how many intellectuals in the second half of the 19th century formed this view as a matter of course, that the human being is actually nothing other than the structure of material processes and their energies, and that thoughts, feelings, and impulses of will are only byproducts. As the third point of the materialistic mechanical worldview, Mr. von Wrangel states the following, quote, number three, "After the physical death of the human being, the existence of the human individual ceases definitively, since the so-called spiritual life of the human being is bound to their physicality and cannot exist without it." Close quote. Everyone can recognize this point as a consequence of the first point. The first point is what matters. The second and third are necessary consequences. In the next small essay, Mr. von Wrangel talks about what he calls, quote, "examination of these basic assumptions." What are these basic assumptions of the materialistic worldview based on? Are they indisputably proven facts, or only more or less probable hypotheses? The most important and momentous of the three assumptions mentioned earlier is the first one about the necessary course of all events. It is not only regarded by materialists as beyond all doubt, but also by many spiritualists who accept the independent existence of spiritual entities and believe in the continued existence of a human being's spiritual being, their soul after physical death, but who accept the immutable laws within the spiritual world, as well as within the world of the senses. First of all, then, let it be stated that this idea of absolute unconditional laws, that is, the necessity of everything that happens, even in the spiritual sphere, excludes the concept of morality, of good and evil, for to act morally is to choose the good when evil could be chosen. Close quote. In this small chapter, Mr. von Wrangel tries to make it clear that there can be no morality if the materialistic mechanical worldview is the only correct one. For if I have to do in every moment of my life what is only a byproduct of the atoms, then there can be no question of freedom, nor can there be any question of morality, for everything is done out of necessity. Just as we cannot say that the stone that falls to the earth is good and the one that does not fall to the earth is not good, so we cannot say of the actions of people that they are good or not good. With the criminal, everything is done out of necessity. With the good person, everything is done out of necessity. Hence there is something correct in the words, quote, "First of all, then, let it be established that this idea of the absolute application of laws without exception, that is, the necessity of everything that happens, even in the spiritual sphere, excludes the concept of morality, of good and evil. For to act morally is to choose good when evil could be chosen." Close quote. But we cannot choose when everything is bound in materialistic necessity. The next chapter is headed, quote, "Freedom and Morality. As soon as there is no freedom of decision, there can be no talk of morality, in the sense in which this concept is understood by people, and as it corresponds to our inner feelings. We may well speak of more or less useful, unfree actions and impulses, but a moral judgment of unfree actions or feelings has no justification, no meaning. With the removal of freedom, accountability also falls away. This undoubted connection between freedom and morality cannot be held as an argument against the concept of the application of laws. It is merely to remind us of the logical consequences associated with the assumption of unconditional necessity." Close quote. So Mr. von Rangel is trying to make it clear here that it necessarily follows from the materialistic mechanical worldview that freedom and morality cannot actually be referred to. Now, he has a scientific mind, and a scientific mind is used to really, in an honest way, drawing the consequences from premises. Our time overlooks many things that would immediately seem absurd to it if it had really already absorbed the scientific conscience, if it did not stir up and throw together all kinds of things without a scientific conscience. Mr. von Rangel does not do that. But he says, if we accept the materialistic view of the world, we must no longer speak of freedom and morality. For either the materialistic worldview is correct, and then it is a nonsense to speak of freedom and morality, or we speak of freedom and morality, and then it makes no sense to speak of the materialistic mechanical worldview. But since Mr. von Rangel is a scientist who is already used to drawing the consequences from his premises, that is an important fact, he is not used to having things so sloppy in his thinking. For it is sloppiness in thinking for a person to say, "I am a materialist," and not at the same time deny morality. He does not want to be guilty of such sloppiness of thinking. On the other hand, he also has the habit that you have when you become a scientist, namely to say, "May the world go to ruin. What I have scientifically recognized must be true." Therefore, you cannot say that you simply throw away the materialistic view. But if the materialistic worldview is true, it must be accepted, and then you are faced with the sad necessity of having to throw morality overboard. So it is not just a question of asking, where are we going with morality? He says that this is not enough. But the materialistic worldview must be examined, irrespective of the consequences this has for morality. So the materialistic worldview must be tackled in a different way. The next chapter is called, quote, "The Riddle of the Universe." Indeed, we can say that the question of whether the human being is responsible for their actions, that is, whether they have the possibility of regulating their will impulses according to motives that are not clearly determined by their bodily organization, that this question about freedom or lack of freedom of the will for us human beings encloses the whole riddle of the universe. For if this question has to be answered in terms of the necessity of all events, which applies absolutely and without exception in the whole universe, then materialism is the only correct view, and the world with all its agony and suffering is a mechanism running without purpose, without a recognizable beginning, but with the eternal death of the whole as its final goal. Close quote. When we began our spiritual scientific movement, I had occasion to read some poems of the poet Marie Eugenie Delagrazzi, who, as we might say, has come to terms with a materialistic mechanical view of the world, and even as a poet, really draws the consequences from it. That is why she has fashioned poems like, quote, "A dirty vortex is existence," close quote. That is the conclusion you have to reach if you are not sloppy in your thinking, if you let your thinking affect your feelings. And it is only because people are so sloppy in their thinking, and so cowardly, that they do not ask themselves the question, what will become of life under the impact of the materialistic mechanical worldview? But surely you must show that it is intrinsically incorrect, otherwise you would simply have adopted the consequence of Delagrazzi. Mr. von Rangel continues, quote, "The great minds, the deepest thinkers, have tried to solve this most important of all questions, and it seems presumptuous to want to say something new about it. But it cannot be a question here of a generally valid answer, but at most an indication of the train of thought which led to a subjective solution of the riddle. Such an indication can sometimes be a help to a similarly attuned soul." Close quote. Mr. von Rangel thus points out that the greatest minds, poets, and thinkers have endeavored to solve this question, and that it is unnecessary to want to say anything new about it. It could at most be an indication of the train of thought that led to a subjective solution to this riddle. In other words, an indication of his own train of thought. In the next chapter, he examines the origin of our notion that the preceding always has the following as its lawful corollary. It is called, quote, "origin of laws." From this point of view, it seems justified to raise the question, from where do we derive the idea that all events are subject to absolute laws? Is it an immediate, intuitive truth that underlies all thinking? Or has humanity only gradually come to this conception through long and arduous mental work? A notion that now appears to be a self-evident truth to the Europeans who are feeding on the cultural heritage of the past? Close quote. So, Mr. von Rangel is asking here, is it the case that human beings have always believed in these absolute laws, or have they only come to believe in them in the course of time? Only then can we understand what the impact of this idea is. For if human beings have always believed in it, there must be something self-evidently true about it. But if human beings have had to work their way through to this idea, it is possible to examine how they arrived at it. In this way, you can get an idea about the validity. He goes on to say, quote, "The latter is the case. It is acquired, not original knowledge. On the contrary, the human being's original, immediate consciousness gives them the idea of inner freedom, limited by external conditions, of arbitrariness in their decisions of will. The idea of conformity with laws is only gradually derived from experience." Close quote. Well, you can see that from countless lectures of mine how slowly people came to this idea of conformity with laws, from the old clairvoyance to the time when the idea of conformity with laws arrived. In truth, the idea of conformity with laws is only 4 centuries old, because it basically stems from Galileo. I have often explained that. If you go back before Galileo, there is no idea at all that everything is pervaded by such a conformity with laws. Mr. von Rangel says, quote, "This is acquired, not original knowledge. The idea of conformity with laws is only gradually derived from experience." Close quote. Well, I would like to know whether the child is compelled by inner astral conditions to reach for the sugar, that is, whether it is natural to them, or whether the child thinks they already have a choice. I have previously told something like an anecdote, which I would also like to quote here. It was in my student days. I used to walk up and down the concourse of Vienna's Südbahnhof station with a fellow student. He was a diehard materialist and firmly held the view that all thinking is just processes in the brain, like the advance of the hands on the clock. And just as you could not say that this was something separate, but was connected with the mechanical materials and forces present in it, he was of the opinion that the brain also made these astronomical movements. That was a Laplacian mind. We were 18 or 19 years old at the time. I once said to him, "But you never say, 'My brain thinks.' You say, 'I think.' Why do you keep lying? Why do you always say, 'I think,' and not, 'My brain thinks'?" Well, this fellow student had taken his knowledge, the ideas of volition and compliance with laws, not from experience, but from complicated theories. He did not believe in inner arbitrariness, but he said, "I think," and not, "My brain thinks." So he was in perpetual contradiction with himself. The next chapter is called, quote, "Freedom of will cannot be proven by experience." Can this contradiction be resolved intellectually? It makes sense that proof of the freedom of will of human beings or other beings based on experience cannot be produced. For this, it would have to be proven that in an actual case, the same being made two different decisions under the same circumstances. Close quote. Mr. von Wrangel thus says that one cannot prove the truth of the freedom of will of human beings by external experience, because you can only make one decision. If you wanted to prove it, you would have to be able to make two decisions. Well, I have also already said that people do not refer to experience at all in this question, but construct an experience. For example, a donkey was once imagined, which had a bundle of hay on the left and on the right, the same tasty bundle of hay of the same size. The donkey, which is getting hungrier and hungrier, has now to decide whether to eat from one bundle of hay or the other, because one is as tasty as the other and as big as the other, and so it does not know whether to turn this way or that. In short, the donkey does not reach any corresponding decision and starves to death between the two bundles of hay. Such things have been constructed because people felt that they could not get to the point of observing freedom through experience. Mr. von Wrangel draws attention to this and then asks the question, quote, "But can freedom of will be refuted by experience?" To answer this question, let us first recall some epistemological truths. Close quote. In order to answer this question, Mr. von Wrangel now speaks about some epistemological truths in the next little chapter. This chapter is called, quote, "Epistemological Review." Human beings have direct consciousness only of themselves. They feel desires which they seek to satisfy and which trigger impulses of will in them. They receive impressions which they soon convince themselves are dependent on certain sense organs of their body. When they close their eyes, they receive no light and color impressions. When they plug their ears, they weaken their sound sensations or lose them altogether. Similarly, experience shows them that the nose conveys the sense of smell, the mouth in its parts, covered with mucous membranes, conveys the sense of taste. Only the sense of touch does not seem to be bound to any particular part of the body, but can be exercised through the entire skin. The normal, healthy human being, when awake, has 5 different senses which convey impressions to them, each sense its specific kind of impressions. Close quote. Here, Mr. von Wrangel is influenced by the popular understanding of the senses. Anyone who heard a small cycle of lectures, which I then entitled Anthroposophy, will have seen that we cannot get by with 5 senses at all. On the contrary, that we have to assume 12 senses. Among these 12 senses is also the sense for the thinking of others, for the I, capital, of others. And therefore anyone who has correctly observed our spiritual scientific movement can recognize the defectiveness of Wrangel's assertions. Although they are not incorrect, they are only partially correct. We cannot say, quote, "The human being has direct consciousness only of themselves," close quote. That is incorrect, because then we could never perceive other eyes, capital. In recent times there has been a very complex view that is held by all kinds of people. Perhaps we might cite the philosopher and psychologist Lipps as a characteristic personality among those who advocate it. They are not aware when they meet a person that they have an immediate impression of their eye, but they say, when I meet a person, they have a face that makes certain movements, and they say certain things, and now you are supposed to be able to conclude from what they say and do that there is an eye behind it. So the eye is something ascertained, not something directly perceived. In contrast, a new school of philosophy, which has its good interpreter in Max Scheler, takes a different view. This has already observed that you can have a direct impression of the other person's eye, and what Husserl, the philosopher, wrote of the eye in a more rigorously academic way, and then Scheler somewhat more popularly, namely in his more recent essays, shows that the more recent philosophy is on the way to recognizing that a direct consciousness can also know something of another consciousness. So we could say Mr. von Wrongel is infected by popular epistemology when he says, quote, the human being has direct consciousness only of themselves, close quote. And further, quote, they feel desires which they seek to satisfy and which trigger impulses of will in them, close quote. And then he describes how human beings perceive the world through their senses. I have also already written about this sensory physiology. Read titled Lucifer Gnosis, and you will see that I try to make clear the impossibility of this sensory physiology with a simple seal comparison. I said at the time, this sensory physiology is already materialistic from the outset. It assumes that nothing can enter us from the outside because it secretly conceives of the outside in a materialistic way. But it is the same as with the signet and the sealing wax. The signet always remains outside the sealing wax. Nothing of the material part of the signet passes over into the sealing wax, but the name Miller, which is imprinted on the seal, is completely transferred from the signet to the sealing wax. If we place the main value on that which is mentally expressed in the name Miller, and not on the material, from which nothing passes over, we can see that what is put forward on the part of sensory physiology means nothing at all. But these are such gruesome teachings hammered into brains, the thing being that most do not follow them, even if they want to become spiritualists. You can read about this in more detail in my book titled The Riddles of Philosophy, in the chapter The World as Illusion. Then Mr. von Wrongel continues, quote, since the human being is unable to conceive that an existing state can change without a cause, they assume that the sensory impressions they feel are brought about by causes they place outside their own directly felt selves. They call these external causes of their inner sensory impressions things, and in their totality, the world, or epistemologically, the non-I, in contrast to the directly felt I. Close quote. That is clear. You just have to get used to the fact that there is a bit of epistemological language. Quote, thousands of experiences and the agreement in this respect with beings they recognize as similar to themselves, their fellow human beings, teach them that these things, the non-I, can exist also independently of their consciousness. Close quote. Otherwise, the human being would have to believe that when they turn their eyes away, not only from living things, but also from inanimate things, these things cease to exist. Quote, if, for example, they lose consciousness during sleep, when they awaken, they find that things continue to exist in their reality, that is, in their ability to evoke sensory impressions in them. The human being also recognizes their own body as belonging, in a certain sense, to the world outside them. Close quote. This is good when it is emphasized, because we do not only have things that are internal, but also things that are external. Quote, they can receive sensory impressions from their limbs, as from other things. For example, they can see their hands, touch them, and so on, and also distinguish here between the inner processes of their sensory impressions and their outer cause, which in this case they recognize as one of their body parts. That it is their body, That is, that this thing has a very special connection with their I, capital, with the thing that feels and thinks. They soon convince themselves of that, especially through the sense of touch, which shows them that when they bring their own body parts into contact with other things, they feel the contact immediately, whereas they do not feel it immediately when other objects are brought into contact with one another. Close quote. It is very good to be made aware of something like this. So this is how Mr. von Rangel answers the question as to how the human being comes to recognize their own body in a specific thing among the things that are in the surrounding space. Those who think sloppily simply say to themselves, thinking about such things is nonsense. It is would-be scientists who think about such things. But Rangel says, when these two chalks bump together, it doesn't hurt. But when I bump into something with my body, it hurts. That is the difference. And because one hurts and the other doesn't, I describe the one as belonging to me and the other as not belonging to me. It is good to know that we have nothing but the consequence of this consciousness. Now, you see, my dear friends, I intended to conclude the discussion of this pamphlet today, but we have only got as far as page 10. An attempt was to be made regarding the way the connection can be found between what is written in the world and what belongs to our spiritual science in a stricter sense. But the next chapters are just too interesting. Formation of concepts, notions of space and time, the principle of causality, applying the notion of arbitrariness to the world around, observation of uniformly progressing phenomena, the essence of all science, astronomy, the oldest science, uniform movement, measuring, the principle underlying clocks. It is so interesting that perhaps we will continue the discussion tomorrow at 7 o'clock after all. The end of Lecture 5.